Thank you very much. It's a real honor and pleasure to be here and to get the opportunity once or twice during the year to address you guys, and it's always nice to be able to be a part of your year and to see the great learning that's going on here. I want to talk about tefillah a little bit, and I'm going to start with a very quick story. And I think if we think about the story and try to think a little bit about what tefillah is about, so I would hope that what we can talk about today will not only be something educational and interesting, but hopefully something that can really impact our tefillah in a very real way. There's a story they tell about the Baal Shem Tov that it was once Erev Rosh Chodesh, and he called together his followers, and he said, "We really need to daven." Some places have a practice that they daven a special davening on Erev Rosh Chodesh, Yom Kippur Katan. And they say slichos, and it's a time for really reaching out and calling out to Hashem. So the Baal Shem Tov came, and he and his Talmidim, they were yelling and screaming and davening. And they saw in the face of the Baal Shem Tov that there must be some very real reason to daven, because they saw the passion in his eyes. In the middle of davening, a little boy walks into the back of the shul, and he stands in the back. He's a farm boy. He doesn't know the davening so well. He certainly doesn't know the special slichos for Yom Kippur Katan. So he starts whistling along with the davening. He doesn't know the words. And he's whistling, and some of the congregants are looking at him in a funny way. But davening ends, and they see a look of relief on the face of the Baal Shem Tov. And they realize that whatever issue was there, so it had been resolved. So the Baal Shem Tov looks at them, and he says, "I know you saw in my face that times were bad, and we really needed to daven. I want you to know that our tefillos were answered because of that little boy in the back who was whistling the davening." That's the Hasidic story that they tell. When you think about this story, what's the message of this story about tefillah? Hasidim don't just tell over this story because it's an interesting historical fact that happened in the Ukraine in the 1700s. They want to tell it over. There's a message they're trying to teach. And I think the message really, without discussing the message yet, I think it really raises a very fundamental question. What really is davening about? And I'd like to present to you two different perspectives on davening. One that I think is very much in line with this story, and one that takes a very different approach than the story indicates. The two modes of tefillah that I would want to discuss tonight, one of them is looking at tefillah as a code, as a password, magic. The words of tefillah were written by Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, by Chazal. And just like if you need to, you know, if you're at the hospital or if you're at the airport and there's that authorized area that not everybody's allowed to walk into, and every once in a while someone walks over, they press the code and the door opens and they go in. There are certain things in the world, there's bracha, there's shefa from Hashem, that in order to access it, you need the code. Chazal gave us the code. They gave us prayer, they gave us tefillah, they wrote the prayers, and they said, say these prayers, right? Sometimes someone's sick and we start saying Tehillim. And we think that by saying the words of Tehillim, so it opens up certain doors, there's something special about the words. It was written by David HaMelech. So it's a code. It's a password. And we all know that if you're trying to get in and you don't remember the password, you could be the most sincere person in the world, you could be best friends with the people on the inside, but if you don't know the password, the door is not going to open. And from this perspective, how we daven is tremendously important. Do we pronounce the words properly? Do we punctuate things in the right place? If you've been in shul, you know there are some people, you might hear from the men's section, sometimes these men who will jump at the chazan or at the Baal Koreh at every single word that he says to correct. It has to be said like this, it has to be said like that. This is the dikduk. So if we want to be malamid tzchus on why they're doing that, they're not just hecklers. Why are they doing that? Because there's something very important to the words of davening. There's a code there. It was written by Chazal, it was written by David HaMelech, some of tefillah. That's one way to look at tefillah. There's a whole other perspective on tefillah, and this is the tefillah that the Baal Shem Tov story talks about. And that is that the words are really not so important. How you punctuate the words, how you pronounce them. Come on, what are you being so, you know, such a stickler about the words? It's not about the words. Davening is about your emotions. It's about your heart. It's about what you feel. That's what the Baal Shem Tov was saying in that story. The boy didn't know the words. He certainly didn't pronounce them properly. He didn't even know the words. But he was connected. His whistling, his singing along with the crowd, there was something passionate there. Now, this is a debate they sometimes have in shuls. Someone will get up and he'll do a song, and he'll be dancing and singing, and he keeps repeating words. And some people say, can't repeat words in davening. And other people say, come on, get into it a little bit, a little Karlbach, a little clapping, a little singing. This is what tefillah is about. It's about feeling it. It's about being connected. So which one is right? Is tefillah code, or is it a heartfelt expression? Are the words really very important, or are the words really not very important at all? Whatever gets you into it, whatever connects you to the emotion. It could be this, and these are two very different perspectives. It could be that these two different perspectives on tefillah is not just something that we're coming up with. It's not just a machlokas between chassidim and misnagdim. But it could even be something that we find in the Gemara itself. We're going to take a look. There's one long source that we're going to be discussing together. Let's read through it together. Itmar, Gemara in Brachos. Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina Amar. Tfilos avos tiknu. Says Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina, how do we have the tfilos? The tfilos are from the avos. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi Amar, tfilos keneged tmidim tiknu. The tfilos were instituted keneged the karbanos. It was a tamid shel shachar. They used to bring a daily korban every morning. That's shachris. They would bring one in the afternoon. The tamid shel ben arbayim, that's mincha. And then at night, they would put all the leftover fats and everything from all the karbanos, and those would burn all night. That's ma'arif. This is the machlokas here in the Gemara. Tanya kavase d'Rav Yossi b'Rav Chanina. Says the Gemara, we have a Tanaitic source that will support Rav Yossi b'Rav Chanina. Something from the times of the Tanoim. The Tanya kavase d'Rav Yoshua ben Levi. And we also have one that supports Rav Yoshua ben Levi. Let's see. Tanya kavasi d'Rav Yossi b'Rav Chanina. The supporting text that we have for the first opinion is the following braisa. Avram tikein tefillah shachris. This is the source that we're familiar with. This is the famous source about the Avos establishing the tefillos. Avram was mesakein tefillah shachris. Shenemar vayashkem Avram baboker el hamokom asher omad sham. Avram woke up and he went to the place that he stood. What does that mean that he stood? Ein amida el tefillah. The place that he davened. Shenemar v'yamod pinchas v'yipalel. Yitzchak was mesakein tefillas mincha. Shenemar v'yetze Yitzchak lasuach basada lifnos erev. Vein sicha el tefillah. So here we have Yitzchak is engaged in a conversation. Avram stood, and the Gemara says stood means amida, right? The tefillas amida is from the Lashon Amida, that we stand. Shmon Esrei. And Yitzchak was involved in a sicha, in a discussion, tefillah. Shenemar tefillah ani kiyato filifnei Hashem yishpoch sicho. We see that tefillah is referred to as a discussion. And Yaakov tiken tefillas arvis. Yaakov was mesakein mariv. Shenemar vayivga b'makom vayolen sham. Right, we just read this. V'ein pigiyah el tefillah. And the lashon of pigiyah, which means to vayivga b'makom, really means that he arrived at the place. But Rashi quotes, Pigiyah is also a lashon of bakasha, a supplication. Ufigu li b'Ephraim ben Socha. That Pigiyah is also a lashon of calling out. Then the Gemara continues, I cut it off the sheet accidentally, and it brings another braisa for Rav Yoshua ben Levi that says that the tefillos were keneged the karbanos. What is this machlokes? Were the tefillos instituted by the avos, or were they instituted keneged the karbanos? Which one? It's a machlokes. What is this machlokes? Maybe this machlokes strikes at the core of what tefillah is about. Karbanos are the most regimented area in halacha. You have to take an animal that's under a year old. It's got to be a male. It can't have any blemishes on it. You have to shecht it. You have to take the bones and put them here. You have to put the sinews over here. You have to put this part over here. You have to catch the blood in this type of vessel. You got to run with it. You got to take it. You got to put it underneath the churah sikra on the mizbeach. Lots of regimented laws. And if you don't follow them, it's pasul. You want to know an area of halacha that's strict? It's karbanos. And you know what? How do karbanos work? How does that mean? How does it work? So maybe you heard, oh, there's a Ramban, it's like instead of you. But when it comes down to it, how do karbanos work? We're not really sure. Hashem says, bring karbanos, and you'll get kapara. Bring kaparos, and you'll be found in my favor. Why? Why should shechting an animal? The Chazal even asks, why does it really make a difference to God how we shecht, what we shecht? Karbanos reflects, perhaps, we'd like to suggest. Karbanos reflects the idea that there are certain things that God told us to do. They're very spiritual, they're very deep. We don't necessarily understand them. They have a lot of rules, and if you follow the rules properly, it does good things for you. The idea that tefillos are keneged karbanos teaches us that tefillah, it's that first perspective in tefillah. That tefillah is like a code. It's like a password. It's like the karbanos. Do it, and you'll get bracha, and you'll get shefa, and you'll get kapara. That's the opinion of Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, that tefillah is like karbanos. So follow the rules, say the words properly, and it opens doors for you. But there's another opinion, and that's the opinion of Rabbi Yossi ben Rabbi Chanina. And Rabbi Yossi ben Rabbi Chanina says, no, tefillah is keneged the avos. What was special about the avos, the tefillah of the avos? Well, you know what? Avram did it in his own way. When? In the morning, and he stood. And Yitzchak had his own form of davening. He connected more in the afternoon. So Yitzchak was an afternoon davening kind of person. And his tefillah was more of a sicha. It was a discussion. It wasn't standing, like, in awe, but it was a discussion. Sicha, that's a different flavor. And Yaakov, he didn't do it in the day, he didn't do it in the morning, in the afternoon. He wanted to do it at night, and it was a whole different type of tefillah. It was a request. It was supplication. It was crying out. What do you get from your Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi? From Rabbi Yossi ben Chanina, that tefillah keneged avos. That tefillah is something that's personal. It's a deep and private expression of my relationship with God. It's not a password. It's not something you just do, and okay, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I said the words, so I guess it works. No, tefillah is very deep, it's heartfelt, it's a personal supplication. I'm going to do it in my way, you're going to do it in your way. And these two opinions in the Gemara present to us tefillah in two different lights. And I think it's very likely that there isn't a machlokas, but that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yossi ben Chanina are highlighting two different elements of tefillah. Tefillah is both a code and is also something that we're supposed to connect to in a very, very private and personal way. Yaakov Avinu says, Vani, Bracious Parak Memches, the next source on the sheet, V'anina sati lochem shechem echar al achecha asher lakachti miyad ha'emori b'charbi u'b'kashti. Yaakov Avinu is talking about his success in war, and he says, how was I successful? I was successful with my cherev and my keshet. What's a cherev? My sword. My keshet? My bow and arrow. Unklus, on this pasuk, forgot to put it on the source sheet for you, but unklus on this pasuk translates into Aramaic the words charbi and kashti as tsilusi ubeusi. Anyone know what those words mean? Tsilusi ubeusi. Now, I know you're thinking sword and arrow. That's not what it means. It's not how he translates it. Tsilusi and beusi are both expressions of tefillah. Those are Aramaic words for tefillah. Tsilusi means prayer and beusi means requests. So Yaakov says, you know, I was successful? The pasuk says I was successful with my sword and my arrow. But Unklus says, and it's quoting Chazal say, you know how he was successful? Through his prayer. Now why in the world did Unklus change? This is like a classic rabbi coming and frumming up a pasuk. The pasuk says he went to war, and comes along the rabbis and say, oh no, it doesn't really mean war, it means prayer. What do you mean? It says battle. It says sword and arrow. What did Chazal see in the pasuk that maybe indicated to them that there was another meaning here? Could be that the order is really backwards. If you've ever been in battle with swords and arrows, so you know that you don't first attack with your sword and then with your arrow. First, from a distance, you shoot the arrows. And then afterwards, if we want to translate it into modern times, you don't send in the foot soldiers before the Air Force. First the Air Force comes in and bombs. And then once the Air Force has leveled the area and bombed, then you send in the infantry to finish off the job. So Yaakov should have said, I was successful with my arrow and with my sword. But he doesn't say that. He says, with my sword and with my arrow. So I'm not sure if this is what hinted to Chazal that there was something different or something hidden here in the pasuk. But Chazal learned in this pasuk that the reference is not to a sword and an arrow. The reference is to tefillah. And why am I sharing this with you? Because if you think about a sword and an arrow, they're very, very different types of weapons. A sword is sharp. If you trip and fall onto a sword, you will get killed. If you're not careful with the tip of a sword and you prick yourself with it, you will bleed. Because the sword is sharp. Before going to battle, they sharpen their swords. But an arrow, or let's talk in modern times, a bullet. You've all seen a bullet? Held a real bullet in your hand? If I would take a bullet and come over and throw it at you, what would it do?
Nothing.
Because it's not intrinsically sharp. What makes it dangerous? The force that you put into it, right? With the arrow, even an arrow, most arrows are pretty blunt at the end of them. What gives it its killing power is the fact that you are pulling back and putting power into the arrow. Says the Brisker Rav, sword and arrow represents two different forms of tefillah. On the one hand, tefillah is a code, it's magic. It's super sharp unto itself. It doesn't matter what you put into it, because it's sharp. It's powerful. It's like a sword. On the other hand, tefillah is something that the more you put into it, the more power you get out of it. And if you don't put any effort into it, you won't get anything out of it. It's like the bullet that you throw at me. It'll just hit me and fall on the floor. It has no power unless you put effort into it. Says the Brisker Rav, these are two different modes of tefillah. Tefillah is on the one hand something that's intrinsically sharp. Even if you don't really know what you're doing, if you just say the words, it does something. But on the other hand, tefillah's power is really felt when you put something into it. It has to be heartfelt. It has to be real. You have to be connected to what you're doing. So why are we discussing two different, really opposite views of tefillah? I mean, which one is it? I would suggest that tefillah has the ability to do both. And the reason why it's important is because there are some days, I think, that we have code, magic days. And there's some days where we have heartfelt, or let's call them karbanos days or avos days. Some days you get to davening and you really feel it. You wake up in the morning, you're excited to daven. When you start davening, you're connecting to the words. You feel inspired, you're passionate about it. And on those days, you have to realize, the more you put in, the more you're going to get out of davening. Because that's how davening works. It has to be real, it has to be heartfelt. But there are other days where we're just not feeling it. And we don't feel connected. Those are days of katnus in Hasidic literature. Days where we feel small. There are days of godless where we feel great. We feel inspired religiously. And it's very natural and common, even for the most dedicated people religiously, to have days where they feel smaller, where they feel less connected. And a person has to realize that on those days, there's another form of tefillah that they can still take advantage of. Tefillah is still a code. There's still a power to the words themselves, even if you don't feel it right now. The words were written by David HaMelech. They were written by Chazal. You know, sometimes, maybe on an Avos day, you need to close the siddur. Because you close your eyes and you really concentrate about the words that you say. And those are Avos days. And your davening is going to be unique. And you're going to be constricted because of the words of davening. You're going to want to go beyond the words. You're going to have your own feelings, your own expressions that aren't even captured well enough by the words because you feel so much more deeply about what you're davening for. And then there are other days where thank God you have the words because you're not feeling anything. And if you didn't have the words, you would have nothing to say. And on those days, you open the sitter and you go through the davening and you read the words and you feel comforted in the fact that you know that at least you said the words of davening. You know, someone who Shmona Esrei is the same length every day is an indication to me that there's nothing really real going on there. Because how can davening be the same length every day? Some days we're more connected, and some days we're less connected. That's the sign of a real relationship. Because tefillah is a relationship. Just like every relationship that we all have. If it's the same every day, it's probably fake. If there are days when it's stronger, there are days when it's weaker, a day where you feel stronger about a person, days where you feel less passionate about a person, that's the sign that there's a real life relationship here. And tefillah should be no different. So if we want to maximize tefillah, so how do we maximize it? Well, it depends what type of tefillah we're talking about. If we're talking about the code form of tefillah, so on those days, we have to make sure we know what the words mean, or at least how to read them properly, how to punctuate them properly, and we need to know the laws. We need to know the dinim, and we all need to learn Hilchos Tefillah. So that way we know what to say, what not to say, where to say, when to sit, when to stand, because you got to do it right. It's karbonos. It's the password here. If you get the password wrong, you're not going to open the door. So that I'll leave to your regular teachers, and hopefully they'll learn with you, or you'll learn on your own Hilchos Tefillah. But that's very important to know Hilchos Tefillah. What I'd like to speak about with the time that we have remaining is how do we make the personal element of tefillah deeper? How do we connect more? What should we be feeling if we want to connect the tefillah? Again, that's not what all of tefillah is about. There's a whole other side of tefillah. And there are many days where we're going to need that code side, that password side of tefillah. But on the days that we're feeling it, what should we be feeling? And how can we increase the days that we're feeling it as opposed to the days where we're just going through it because it's a code and we'll say it and sit down? So I'd like to begin with the Rambam in order to, for the second half of the shiur, to discuss what is the proper perspective on tefillah. The Rambam tells us in the beginning of Hilchos Tefillah that there are a number of things that are ma'akev, the kiyum of tefillah, things that prevent you, hold you back from being yotzei davening. One of them is, for instance, nikiyus, that you have to be clean, whether it means washing your hands or not being dirty and disheveled. That's one thing that's ma'akev tefillah. One of the things that the Rambam lists, another thing, is that you have to be in a clean area, specifically if there's animal or human feces within Da'or Amos of you. So then you're not allowed to daven. And if you daven in that area, you're not yotzei davening. Certain halachos that apply. That's what we know. We have to, in the morning, we have to wash our hands before we daven. We don't paskin that it's ma'akev, but the Rambam writes it's ma'akev. So one of the things that the Rambam writes is ma'akev. The Rambam writes, kavanas halev. Have kavanah. If you take a look at the Rambam, take a look at the third source here, Perek Dal, Halacha Tezvav, the Rambam says something seemingly very extreme. Kavanah Salev Ketzad. What does it mean to have kavanah? Kol tefillah. She'ena bekavanah, eina tefillah. If you don't have kavanah, it's not davening. V'im hispalel below kavanah, chozer mispalel bekavanah. Wow. If you daven without kavanah, you have to daven again. Matzah daito mishubeshes v'libo tarud. If you find that you can't really daven, you can't really focus, aser lo lispal ad shetis yashev daito. You can't daven until you are able to focus, until you clear your mind. That's one Rambam, and that's in Perek Dalet. However, if you read six prakim later, you get a very different perspective from the Rambam. Here the Rambam is discussing the halachos of Shmon Esrei, and he says, Misha ispalo v'lo kiven es libo, someone who davens and doesn't have kavana, yachzor v'yispalel bekavana. Go back and daven again. Okay, everything's good so far. Consistent. V'im kivein es libo bivracha rishona, shuv eino tzarech. But if you had kavana for the first bracha, so then it's okay. You don't need any more kavana for the rest of davening. So we have a contradiction here. In Perek Dalet, the Rambam made a very grand statement. Whenever you don't have kavana, the davening doesn't count, you need to start again. And then in Perek Yud, the Rambam tells us, oh yeah, that only applies to the first paragraph of Shemoneh Esrei. That's a big difference. So the Chazon Ish comes and says, well, the Rambam in Perek Yud is just further explaining what he said in Perek Dalet. Perek Dalet, he told you the idea that Kavona has the ability to prevent you from being Yotzei Davening. And in Perek Yud, he tells you where that applies. That's how the Chazon Ish works out this contradiction between the Rambams. But Rav Chaim Soloveitchik has a different explanation. And he suggests that the Rambam in these two parakim is talking about two different types of kavana. There's two different types of kavana in tefillah. One type of kavana is what he calls kavana for what the words mean. And that you only need to have for the first paragraph of Shemoneh Esrei. For the rest of Shemoneh Esrei and the rest of davening, you don't have to know what the words mean. It's better to, but you're still yotzei. That's what the Rambam meant in Perek Yud, that if you don't have kavana, you're not yotzei. It's only for the guarding the words, of what the words mean. But what did the Rambam mean in Perek Dalid when he said, seemingly, that for all of davening, if you don't have kavana, you're not yotzei? That's a much more basic form of kavana. That's the realization and the recognition that you're omed lifnei Hashem. So there's a baseline kavana, that you realize you're standing before God. That, if you don't have that, you're not yotzei at all in davening. Then there's a higher level kavana, not only to realize that you're standing before God, but to actually know what the words mean. That is only required for the first paragraph of Shemoneh Esrei. So what does the Rav Chaim Soloveitchik mean when he says that according to the Rambam, if you don't realize you're standing before God, you're not yotzei tefillah? Anywhere, in any part of tefillah. What does it mean to have a recognition that you're standing in front of God? So I want to read to you another Rambam, and it's a very beautiful Rambam. The Rambam is in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah. Look what the Rambam says. Bisha sheyizbonein ha'adam b'masav u'bruav ha'nifloim. When a person contemplates the actions and the creations, wondrous, big, wondrous and tremendous creations, v'yirah mehen chachmaso, and he sees the chachma of Hashem, she'ein la'erech v'lokeitz, that it has no, someone have a good translation, it has no end, it's infinite, his chachma, miyad, what it happens to a person, when a person realizes who Hashem is, miyad hu nirta la'achorov, what does that mean, nirta la'achorov? Anyone know? He jumps back. He recoils. V'yifached, and he's scared. V'yodeya shehu bria ketana, and he knows that he's a small creation. Shvela, afela, lowly, dark. Omedes bedas kala, he's weak-minded. Lifnei tmim deyim, certainly in comparison to the ultimate perfect intellect, Hashem. Kimosha Amar David, as David HaMelech said, Ki era shamecha maset sposecha, when I see the heavens, the handiwork of your fingers, I think to myself, Ma enosh ki tiz kerenu. I think to myself, who exactly is man? When a person realizes how vast, how huge the universe is, a person realizes right away, feels his smallness. We're not going to get into the science class right now, but just very briefly, just to give you a small idea of the size of the universe. We know that sound travels, correct? Sound travels around 800 miles an hour. What does that mean? That means that if I'm standing on one mountain, and you are standing on another mountain, and you're 800 miles away from me, and I scream, hey! It'll take a second until you hear me. If you're 1,600 miles away, it's going to take 2 seconds. Because the sound waves need to travel. Now they travel 800 miles a second. 100 miles an hour, excuse me. So it'll take, if you're 800 miles away, it would take an hour. 800 miles an hour. Okay? That's how long it takes for sound to travel. We know sometimes if you yell someone really far, there's a little bit of a delay. So if it's 800 miles away, which is a very far distance, it would take time because it takes time for the sound waves to travel. That's why sometimes here in Eretz Yisrael, a fighter plane goes by, and then you hear the whoosh after the plane goes by, because the plane is going faster than the speed of sound. Well, light also travels. Light is also a wave. So, light travels a lot faster. Anyone know how fast light travels? Not 800 miles an hour. Anyone know? 186,000 miles a second. 186,000 miles a second. That's around the Earth a number of times in a second. That's how fast light travels. So, for instance, if you were now on a mountain 186,000 miles away, that's very, very far. Okay? You're 186,000 miles away. And I go like this with my hand, it would take you a second to see that. Because it takes time for the light to travel. Okay? This concept is okay? We have something that we call light years. Stars, like the closest stars are like 7 light years away, 8 light years away, 10 light years away. What's a light year? A light year is the amount of time it takes light to travel in a year. So let's just do the math very quickly. 186,000. Is there a... No? Okay, 186,000. 186,000 a second. So let's multiply that number by 60. Now we got to a minute. Let's multiply it by another 60. Now we got to an hour. Let's multiply that by 24. Now we got to a day. Let's multiply that by 365. Now we got to a year. So anyone following along here, what number did we get up to? This is a huge number. Huge, okay? That's the amount of time, that's how much light travels in 1 year. So stars are 10 light years away. That means that they are a distance that it would take 10 years for the light to travel. In a very simple sense. You know what that means? That means when you're walking tonight outside, and you look up at a star, and the star twinkles. It twinkled. You guys are 18? Around? So it twinkled when you were 8. You just didn't see it. It took 10 years for the light to travel to Earth. So when you walk outside and you see a star twinkle, that happened when you were 8. But traveling at 186,000 miles a second, it took, until we saw it, it took 10 years. Traveling at that speed per second. And those are the closest stars. So the universe is huge. And when a person starts to think about things like this, so immediately, the immediate reaction is, as the Rambam says, I am a tiny, almost insignificant creature in this world. Now, that's a little depressing. But the Rambam says, that's what happens when a person really starts to contemplate nature and really starts to contemplate who God is. When a person stands in front of God, remember Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said, the definition of tefillah, of kavana, is to stand before God. And the Rambam tells us here in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, what does it mean to stand before God? It means to realize who God is and to realize who you are. And at that moment, a person is overcome with feelings of vulnerability, of realizing how you acutely feel your finitude, the fact that you're finite, when you're standing in front of He that is infinite. And that is a very humbling experience. You see, when we learn Torah, the bracha we make is Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Am. We go into learning with a feeling of greatness, that we're special. It speaks to the godless of us. Davening, I'd like to argue to you tonight, is supposed to be entered into with the absolutely opposite perspective. I'm not encouraging you to have a low self-esteem or to feel small. I'm telling you that the proper attitude when one davens is to feel small in comparison to Hashem. You can't really daven unless you feel and recognize your vulnerability. Unless you recognize how small you are and insignificant you are in comparison to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's a low feeling, and that's a sad feeling. But that's the feeling that a person has to have during tefillah. And you know what? Tefillah, and that feeling is very hard to have. We, as modern people, have accomplished so much in the realm of technology, health, medicine. It's very easy for a person to stand there in davening and to say things like, Hashem, my parnasa comes from you, but to really know that it's actually because I'm a very, very good lawyer. That's actually why I'm very wealthy. I mean, Hashem, I need your help, but you should see me in the courtroom. That's really why I'm very successful. And health? Well, I have my nutritionist, and I eat carefully. We have so much knowledge. We have so much control. Hashem even told us to do it. He said, Mala aretz v'kiv shuha, go out and conquer. And we were mekayim that to the nth degree. We conquered the world. Communication, technology, medicine. It's very easy for a person to feel that they're not vulnerable. How often do we feel vulnerable? Maybe we're on a plane and then there starts to be really bad turbulence. We all of a sudden are grabbing onto the side of the chair, and for a minute we feel vulnerable. How often do we walk and feel vulnerable, that we're not really in control of our lives? And yet, Reb Soloveitchik said it, and I'm not trying to depress anyone. You know, there's a room full of people here. So there must be people in the room who are going through hard times in life. That's just the statistics, obviously. But for many young people, so, you know, once you have a child, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. When that little baby is born, first night you bring the baby home, every time it makes like a little like, you like jump out of bed and you like check, is it breathing? Is it too hot? Is it too cold in the room? Every second, because you're terrified. You feel like the child's vulnerable. Child's getting really sick, gets a fever. I remember we had a baby born a few months ago, very high fever a month or two after, sitting there at 2 o'clock in the morning, should we go to the hospital, should we not go to the hospital? You know, reading online like, oh gosh, over 102, you gotta go to the hospital right away. You know, it could be life-threatening. You're terrified when you have you feel like the child is so small, so vulnerable. Are we really so different? We feel like we are. And if you feel like you are, you can't really daven. If you really feel that you're not vulnerable, real davening, anyone who's ever been in a tough time, and I'm sure some of us are, somebody is sick, somebody's struggling with something, you know what those davenings are like. You know how you really connect when you feel like you really need God? That's what I mean by vulnerable. I'm not saying that we should feel insignificant, but if we don't really feel like we need God, so then davening isn't powerful. Rav Soloveitchik said it in such a powerful way. It's almost like I get you know, goosebumps when I think of this line. He says, man somehow has figured out a way to put a man on the moon, and yet we cannot stop one single cell from taking over the body and killing the person. He's obviously referring to cancer. He says, how can we take a person and put him on a moon, and yet we can't stop a tiny, tiny little cell in a person from taking over their body? On the one hand, we look at certain things and we say, wow, we are amazing. We've accomplished so much. And in our personal lives, we could, if we're financially successful, if we're healthy. So I don't feel like anything's shaking. Everything's great. And yet at the same time, if we take a second and we think about it, if we think about how vulnerable life is, how fleeting it is, we all feel this way. You know, you get sick. You get a small little virus and you can't move, you can't think, you can't talk, you can't do anything. You're lying in bed like, from what? A tiny little germ. And at those moments, we don't feel, oh, I'm amazing, I could do anything. Davening, the challenge of davening well, at least in terms of connecting in a very, very deep way, is only when we are able to be aware and cognizant of our own vulnerability and our own dependence on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's when davening, we start to really connect to what we're doing. And I thought perhaps that this can even be reflected in a famous machlokas about tefillah. We know that shachris is a chova. You need to daven shachris. Mincha is a chova. But Mariv, the Gemara says, is a rishus. Mariv is a machlokas, really. Rav Yehoshua and Rav Eliezer. One Tana says that Mariv is also a chova. And one Tana says that Mariv's a rishus. What does the opinion of rishus hold? I mean, is Yaakov less significant than Avram and Yitzchak? How come Avram's davening got to be a chova? And Yitzchak's davening, a chova. But Yaakov's davening? Maybe it's a rishus, machlokes. Maybe it's just
optional. Our immediate reaction is, why is Ma'ariv getting, you know, relegated to a low-level tefillah? I want to actually argue the complete opposite. I want to argue that Shachris needs to be an obligation. Because when you wake up in the morning, you feel amazing. And you're ready to conquer the day. And there's a whole fresh day and the sun is out. And Mincha is the same way. It's bright out. It's the day in the middle of your activities. But Ma'ariv, and this is certainly much more significant than their time, when they didn't have electricity, Ma'ariv is a very fearful time. You don't go out at night. Streets aren't lit up. Night is a scary time, even as children. I'm sure we all related to that. Even if there were lights on our house, there's something about night that, you know, there's a fear. There's a fear that we associate with the darkness of night. At Ma'ariv, you don't need to command anyone to daven Ma'ariv. That's the most natural tefillah that there is. What else are you going to do at night? I had a good friend who had a son who was born with a heart condition. And there was a real question about, at first, it was really life and death. But they had to go through a bunch of very serious surgeries. And they went to Tel HaShomer, which is the hospital in Tel Aviv. Right in the heart of Tel Aviv. Tel HaShomer. And we know Tel Aviv is not Yerushalayim in terms of commitment to Torah and mitzvot. And he said it was an amazing thing that in the waiting room outside of the surgery area where the children's surgery is, the waiting room only has one set of books in it. Tehillim. In the Tel Aviv hospital, there's no Time or Newsweek or whatever other magazines other people might want to read. The only reading material in the waiting room there is Tehillim. Because everybody, it doesn't matter who you are, everybody, when all of a sudden the world starts crumbling around you and you feel dependent and you feel vulnerable, everybody turns to prayer. So I want to argue that Ma'ariv, you know why it might be a reshus? Not because it's less important, because it's so natural that we don't need to command it. Shachris needs a commandment. Mincha needs a commandment, because you have to get off of your high horse once in a while and say, you know what? Even though Hashem gave me a lot of rain to be able to do what I want, rain with a G, to be able to do what I want, not rain, like ability to do things, even though Hashem gave me a lot of freedom and rain to do what I want, but I have to remember that even at those times, I'm dependent on Hashem. And therefore, the tefillos of Shachris and Mincha need to be a chiyuv. I'll end with one last point. There's a machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban about the nature of the chiyuv of tefillah. The Rambam holds that there's a mitzvah d'oraisa to daven every day. However, the Ramban argues. The Ramban says it's not a mitzvah to daven every day. It's only a mitzvah be'eis tzara, at times of trouble. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik that the minute the Ramban admitted that there's a chiyuv be'eis tzara, he admitted that the Rambam is really right. He lost the machlokas as soon as he admitted that. Because Rav Soloveitchik said, the Rambam also holds there's only a chiyuv d'oraisa at an eis tzara. It's just that the Rambam knows that every day is really an eis tzara. Every day a person should be feeling that they're in need of Hashem's help. And if they don't have Hashem's help, then they're really in trouble. And the reason the Rambam says that, he agrees to the Ramban, tefillah is only a d'oraisa be'eis tzara. But guess what? Every day is an eis tzara. Every day when a person davens, they need to feel that vulnerability, that dependence on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So 95% of the day, you should walk around feeling like $1 million and you should feel great about yourself. But when we take those three steps into Shmona Esrei, that's an opportunity for a person to think, wait a second, what are the things that I'm taking for granted in my life? What are the things that I think are in my control and aren't really in control? And as you go through davening, whether it's health, whether it's parnasa, whether it's the situation here in Eretz Yisrael, great example, situation here in Eretz Yisrael. Baruch Hashem, we've had a bunch of months of relative quiet. But anyone here knows, you open a news story, type into Google, terrorist attack in Israel, and you will not have any shortage of horrible and sad, sad stories of things that happen here in Eretz Yisrael and have happened here. We can't take for granted the peace that we have right now. And what do we say? Oh, the, you know, the Shin Bet and the, you know, the security, the Modin, the what's it called? Yeah, what's the English word? The intelligence. The intelligence here in Eretz Yisrael is amazing. And don't worry, they've been stopping so many terrorist attacks. That's not the answer. It is. That is the Derech Teva way that we're being protected. But we have to be very thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the amazing amount of relative peace that we've had. So all of Tefillah gives us an opportunity to recognize how much we need HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And hopefully, if we do that, if we are aware of our vulnerability during davening, so it will hopefully allow us and help us to really connect to Tefillah and to allow our Tefillos to not only be powerful because they're a sword, because there's a code, there's a password that we're using, and that we're able to be zocha to things through that. But in addition, it should be because our tefillos are heartfelt. We feel our dependence on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When we sit down to learn, we feel like $1 million. But when we enter into davening, we go in humbly. As the Rambam says, standing before the Tmim Dayim, standing before God, we realize who we are, we realize who He is, and if we recognize how much we need Him, so hopefully we'll be zocha to everything that we need. Thank you very much, guys. Have a great rest of the year. Hopefully I'll see you at some other point.